Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Grisha Stewart. Grisha MA CPDTKA is an author, international speaker, and dog trainer who specializes in dog reactivity. She runs Empowered Animals LLC and the online Animal Building Blocks Academy from Deadwood, Oregon. She founded and ran Ahimsa Dog Training in Seattle for 13 years, earning many awards, including Best of Western Washington. Ahimsa is a Buddhist doctrine of nonviolence to all living things, which reflects Grisha's focus on empowerment to promote the well-being of dogs and their humans. Her latest book, Behavior Adjustment Training 2.0, New Practical Techniques for Fear, Frustration, and Aggression, was published by DogWise in early 2016. Her popular second book, The Official Ahimsa Dog Training Manual, A Practical Force-Free Guide to Problem Solving and Manners, was published in 2012 and updated in 2014. And her popular BAT 2.0 DVD series about empowered socialization and training was released in the same year, 2014. Grisha has a master's degree in mathematics and graduate work in animal behavior. She is an enthusiastic and entertaining presenter who creates her seminars to accommodate a variety of learning styles. So without further ado, it is my very great pleasure to welcome one Grisha Stewart to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Grisha, good morning, good afternoon to you. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Ryan. I love where I am in Oregon, but it's a shame I'm not in New Zealand. I love it there too.
Yeah, it's beautiful here in New Zealand. For anyone out there in podcast land who hasn't been here, it is a beautiful country. I do feel somewhat isolated occasionally. We're pretty far away from everything.
Yes, it was actually the most grueling intake I've ever done in terms of flying into the country. They're like, have you been hiking? Are there any seeds on your boots? They're very specific because it is an island and not overrun with a lot of things.
Yeah, a lot of people say that if you are coming here, be prepared to have clean boots.
Yes.
Yep. And leave your seeds at home. Hey, we're going to get started and dive into the first question today, Grisha. Could you please take everyone listening back to where you first got started, where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training, and share some stories? We love stories here at Animal Training Academy. Share some stories of some of the first animals you ever trained using it.
So, well, the very, very beginning was probably just teaching the dogs that I had and the dogs of the people that I babysat how to jump over agility jumps using treats or motivation. And I think I did a lot of jumping over the jumps with the dogs and praising them for that. So it actually turned out there's an organization that does agility in the Northwest in Idaho, and the lady who, when she was off doing agility, she had a daughter, and the daughter needed a babysitter. And so I babysat her daughter, which we actually found out many years later, she didn't know she had a babysitter while she was gone. So that was kind of interesting that the husband had me babysit without her her knowing that. But anyway, so I worked with her agility dogs while she was gone. Some of like the ones that were not competing. So, and then fast forward many years, my actual real introduction to positive training came from, I got a dog and my boyfriend at the time was, we were both in graduate school for math. Well, I was for mathematics and he was there for computer science. And he said that before we got a dog, we should read some books. And so I read about 50 dog training books, because that's what you do when you're in grad school, is you get really good at reading things fast. And so I read a bunch of books, wrote a little like a book report on each one. We had a discussion. I got a dog. And then we went to a class actually that used a prong collar. So she had the trainer was like, this is like power steering. And I had read in some of the books that it was okay and some of the books that it wasn't. So I was still kind of not ethically sure of where I stood. And so I actually did use one for about 6 days and then realized that that was not the relationship that I wanted with Spoon, the dog I was working with. And so then what I started doing was just experimenting with positive training. I had so outside of the class, I had a juice lid that made a little popping sound. And so I used that as my first clicker. And the first thing that I taught her was to turn her head and look over at my boyfriend at the time. And so I was just like, this is amazing. Like you can reach inside her brain and communicate something to her without showing or, you know, that you can actually communicate. So I was pretty much sold at that point. And then I started taking classes at the Humane Society, which had positive classes, and eventually then volunteering there and working with the dogs there. So, and actually, interestingly, many years later, after I had started AHIMSA dog training and, you know, we had 40 classes a week by that time. And one of the students who came through was my old teacher. And so I was able to teach her some more about positive training. So that was kind of a nice full circle experience.
Yeah, very cool. So what was the time gap between jumping over agility hurdles with your...
It was quite a gap, actually. So I think I was probably 12 or 13 when I was babysitting. And then it was, oh, I don't know, I'm going to say 25. No, yeah, probably 25 when I was starting to do classes with Spoon.
And what was your original life plan? Because you're studying maths, you got your master's in maths.
Yeah, so my original plan was to get a PhD and teach at a university. And then what happened is probably that I got the dog somewhere in the middle of that. And so I ended up deciding that I would rather teach human beings that like who are really interested in kind of a crux of change. And so I got out at the master's level and started teaching at a community college. I got a tenure track position there. But then that same time, I also started my business as a dog trainer. So by then I had already gotten that passion going. So I was teaching just, you know, one or two classes a week, renting from a dog daycare and teaching math during the day and doing dog training at night. And then so for that whole first year, it was ramping up and up and up in the dog training business. And then still working full time as a mathematician. And so I ended up taking a year leave of absence after that first year from the college and diving head on into the dog training. And then by the time that year was up, I decided that's all I really wanted to be doing.
Wow.
And that was 15 years ago. So,
yeah. And I think you've kind of added some new potential meat to the term behavior nerd, reading 50 books. What? So that was about 15 years ago. You were
with
like
the,
at
with
that
the
stage.
Books?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was probably 15 years ago.
So what was some of the?
Well, that was no. So the books were probably 17 years ago because the yeah. 15 was when I started the business.
So what were some of the seminal books at that time that you think, you know, was it one book that you read that kind of still sticks with you to this day?
Well, definitely Patricia McConnell's books were huge for me. I read I think Family Dog Training was one of them. And she was actually my very first seminar I ever attended was one of Trisha's. And it was great. I took Spoon to that. And I remember she was trying to identify breeds and do some like study. And so I volunteered her for that because Spoon was like a blue-eyed basset hound border collie mix. So that was awesome. But yeah, the other book I remember at the time was one that I fell for at the time, but then realized was not reasonable, The Dog Listener. So Jan Fennell. So that was a book it was all about like you have to eat before the dog and, you know, kind of standard dominance-based stuff, but it was without the force part. It was sort of psychological dominance. And so that made at least sense, like more sense to me than the throw the dog on the ground aspect. But then, of course, that turned out to not be necessary either.
And so you read the books and then you additionally were at the same time or kind of after that, I guess. So 16 years ago.
Sure. I'm a mathematician, not a historian. We'll see how this goes.
Taking Spoon to some classes. Mm-hmm. And someone told you that you said a prong collar is like a power steering?
Like power steering. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, which at the time kind of made sense, right? Because you actually then are able to steer the dog with much like less force on your part, but that's because it's stabbing into the dog's neck. So they're like, ow. And so it's a lot easier. I'm putting in air quotes here, but like easier to turn them, but it's not easier for the dog. So like the work that I do now with that, using a harness and a long line and all of that, that's really power steering. I mean, that's the sense of like just using this very light touch to be able to direct a dog. And that's the idea, you know, like, I mean, so power steering makes sense, right? As an actual term. Mm-hmm. Right. So like, you know, old school, it was manual, right? So you had to really crank on the wheel in order to get the car to turn. Power steering makes it much more simple. Like anybody can do it.
Yeah.
And so that's the idea.
And from the historian point of view, I guess 16 years ago, that was like not commonplace.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Power steering was just coming in as well. No, I think it had been in for a while. But my car at that time, I think, did not have power steering either. To be fair.
So what's the 2018 metaphor? It's like saying, we've changed it to power steering is kind of like using bat, but we could say like 2018 model is like positive reinforcement is kind of like having a smart home.
There we go. Yes. Yeah. There's got to be a metaphor in there somewhere. I'm not sure I'm going to make up a good one quickly, but yeah, a lot of times I say though that bat is like meditation. So it's really about reducing arousal so that you can have good decisions and, you know, kind of inserting, this is to quote Viktor Frankl, but it's inserting a space between stimulus and response.
Oh, don't think we've had that on the podcast before. Yes.
Excellent. First.
So Viktor Frankl, remind me, is a guy who survived
Holocaust. Survivor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And his book is called Man's Search for Meaning, is it?
That sounds good. I don't know. I'm going to quote you on that.
So we've got this word that I had to double check with you that I was going to pronounce right, which is ahimsa. Mm-hmm. Did I get that right?
Mostly ahimsa, yeah.
Ahimsa. And so that, as I mentioned in your bio, is a Buddhist doctrine of nonviolence to all living things.
Yes.
And you think about that kind of like meditation now, you said. So how important is this kind of like your spiritual side?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And how important is that to like how you think about what you do with dogs and your training?
It's super key. It's everything, because the way that we are in all of our interactions is the way that reflects who we are, right? So we can't be to my view, we can't simultaneously be one way with our dogs and another way with the rest of humanity. And so it's I feel like we treat our dogs like we treat our inner child. And so as we become more self-aware, I think the way that we interact with our dogs is also different. I think we can learn a lot by the way that we interact with our dogs and the voices that we project on them. So the things that we think they say about us, just like with anyone we love, it really reflects more about us than it does about them. So, and I think that it's important to have a scientific perspective. So we're getting data, we're making sure that our techniques are working, but that we're also in touch with how this fits in with our ethics and our spiritual side, because I think that's important too.
Yeah. And I think I'm going to kind of come back to some of this later on in the podcast and talking about how we talk to ourselves. So let's shelf that for now, because I want to kind of unpack it a bit more, but I think we'll do it in a more strategic fashion later on in the recording.
Strategery.
We'll see how we go. So let's bring everyone up to speed now. Thank you for sharing all of that. And just maybe build upon, because I've already mentioned it.
Because who is this person anyway? What are we doing?
build on where you are now, what you're doing now, and where people can go to find out more information about you and get in touch.
Okay. Let's see. So I teach seminars, and I also teach online. I have online courses that are like self-paced. And then I also do an online school where there's about, I think, 200 hours of video, as well as a Facebook group and some other content, that kind of thing. There's different levels. There's one for professionals and one for students. And that's all on my website, which is just my name, GrishaStewart.com.
Smart.
Yeah, right. It took me a while to get to that. So I like inventing things, and I like change, and I like progress. And so I realized after having like 3 or 4 different websites that I need something that I'm never going to change, because otherwise I have to keep redirecting. So pretty solid on my name at this point. So yeah, that's where I went with that.
Watch out for www.thedogtrainer, formerly known as GrishaStewart.com.
There we go. Once I change my name to a symbol. Yeah.
And we will link all of that in the podcast write-up as well. And yeah. Online
I have
courses.
Some of my music in there too. I don't have a ton of music. I'm not an amazing musician, but I have a song about that that's in there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Can we share that song?
Sure. Absolutely.
Not right now.
It's on YouTube. Yeah, no.
Share it in the podcast write-up.
I don't have my guitar.
No, you're quite into music as well. I saw on your Facebook page, mm-hmm. you shared one of your friend's songs recently, yep. which was nice.
Yes, he's much more talented than me. Well, let's say much more experienced. How about that?
So. We've all got imposter syndrome.
Yes, right, right.
So you've been doing online stuff for how long?
See, again with the numbers. I don't know, 5 years, let's say. So, I started my school, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. And I really enjoy it. I like being able to reach people all around the world and not put quite a strain on the planet and my own body as well, right? So if I go for a weekend seminar, then it's actually like 4 or 5 and sometimes 6 days of getting there, right? So there's the travel, there's the decompression, there's the speaking and all that. So it's great to be face-to-face with people, but it's nice to have something that's a little bit lower energy so I can do more.
And you're telling me when you caught up month or so ago that you kind of manage your life in different stages now. So you go through periods of intense kind of travel, mm-hmm. and then long periods of decompression at home.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it gives me a chance to write. So just to work with my own dogs and to be in my forest, and which is amazing to have. And yeah, it's, I think there's a culture of busyness, and we mentioned that a little bit before we started on air here, that I think there's a little bit of a competition of like who can be the busiest, that busyness is success, and it isn't. I mean, so it's a way to just, we overproduce, but the quality in terms of what we do for our own souls and the connection that we have with people, that goes down when we end up being so busy. And so really I've put an emphasis in at least the last 3 or 4 years on quality of interaction over quantity, and being able to say, these are the places where I excel in communicating and making a connection, and that it feels really good to me. And these are the things that I need to cut out because I'm not able to be 100% committed to it. And I have lots of ideas, and I love coming up with new things. And so it's very hard for me to say, no, this is a project I need to tell someone else about so that they can get all fired up about it and do that instead. But I'm not the person to sail that ship.
Awesome. I love it. And I am thinking a lot about these things now myself. And I look forward to the day when I can say, I just want to be in my forest. Yes. I very much look forward to that.
Yes. If you get a chance, one of the books I really like, which I end up getting, I think, as a referral from Kathy Sadeo, it's called Essentialism, Greg McKeown. Okay. And it's a really good book. There's actually, I'll just plug my own site, actually, now that I think about it. There's an interview with him on my site. He's not a dog trainer, but I did like a series of little interviews with various professionals that I found useful. His approach is really good. So just kind of paring down to the essentials of where can you contribute most to society? Where do you feel the best? And what do you have to say no to in terms of the rest of it?
Yeah, and thanks for putting that in there. No relation to Joel McQuiggan, obviously.
No. Yeah, and actually McEwen is his last name, so no relation to Teresa McEwen either.
McEwen.
Or McKeon, yeah. McKeon. Yeah, McEwen I think is how he says it, and McEwen, but right. Anyway, yeah.
And it's not the first time we've had potentially a book which people might class as similar mentioned in the podcast. Sirag Patel mentioned Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now, which kind of is more taking us away from dog training, but not.
Mm-hmm. Right, it's all related.
Yeah, cool. Awesome. I'll link to that. Maybe if you can send me the exact URL for that interview, then we can link to that if anyone wants to find out more. Thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Grisha. I could do a whole podcast, I think, just learning about people's behavioural odysseys, as I like to call them. So appreciate you sharing. Moving forward, though, I'd really like to talk about BAT.
So okay.
Can I leave it there? Can we just get going? How about we start with how did BAT get started?
Well,
what is BAT?
Yeah, what is BAT? So BAT stands for Behavior Adjustment Training. And the way that it got started originally was, so I had been training using positive training, working with reactivity cases, and my own dog, Peanut, my soulmate dog who passed away a couple of years ago, he was, basically I had him at the point where he had issues with kids and dogs and men and bicycles and anything really when he was younger, but I had worked through the bicycles with classical counter conditioning. And then in terms of the men and the kids and the kind of all humans, really, he was to the point where if he was in working mode, if he was paying attention to me, then he would look fine. Like we could heal past someone. I wouldn't necessarily need to be giving him treats at the time. He could still be functional as long as he knew I was paying attention. But the moment that he was like off the clock, if he was just wandering around or, you know, loose leash walking next to me, then his reactivity distance was actually more like 50 or 100 feet. So much further. So about 30 meters for those of you in meters. And so it was, you know, embarrassing, right, as a trainer, and also sad because that meant that he's having a really hard time. And so I was looking for other tools. I discovered CAT at the time, constructional aggression treatment. And that is a technique that it's based on negative reinforcement. It's not a technique that I would necessarily do anymore, but it's also the way that I did it even then was less aversive to the dog. So it was still had a component of flooding, which that technique does have. And so basically, as soon as I started doing it, I was like, well, why am I doing it this way? Why do we set him up to bark? Why can't we just start further away? And why is he not the one moving? And so let's move him further away, let him be the one that approaches the trigger. So there were various components of that technique that I was like, oh, I'm not so content with this. And so I started tweaking it more and more. And then I presented it to the people who did that technique and as potential changes. And they were like, yeah, no, good job coming up with your own thing, but no, we won't do that. And so kind of jokingly between me and a friend, we were like, let's call it BAT. Like, and so I just made up my own name for it. And then that kind of stuck. So, so that's where it started. And so that was the original version of BAT. And then over time, little bits have been tweaked. And then there was kind of a moment in 2013, toward the end of 2013, when I decided that the technique needed to be upgraded. And just to rewind actually a little bit. So with BAT, then basically what I did was I worked Peanut through his issues with people. And he ended up being a therapy dog for a senior center, which was great. So he really started to enjoy petting. He had about five or six people that had ever touched him before we did this kind of work with him. And when he was doing counter conditioning, it was like he was had amnesia. So we could work with the same decoy over and over and over again. And he would just like, it would be a new one every time. And when we started doing doing this without the food and just using distance, he definitely remembered them. And so his progress was a lot faster. So anyway, should I continue on with that? Okay. So back to the 2014, end of 2013 part. So I was teaching a 5-day course and I realized that people were still putting their dogs over threshold, like even by day 5. And so it had me thinking, like, why is this, right? So if people are doing something wrong, it's either there's something wrong with the technique or it's something wrong with the instruction, right? So it can't be everybody is stupid, right? And so you immediately, you know, I look at what can I change, right? And so I did a couple of things. So I watched a ton of video about of setups and then just dogs in general interacting and watching for what's the biggest tell that the dog is going over threshold. And so what I saw was basically that the straight line approach was the biggest one. So as soon as they aligned the spine, that was the key that everything else was going to go downhill from there. And so that's how we now distinguish where the threshold is. And obviously, if the person sees any other behaviors for that dog and says, now we're starting to get over aroused, that's also considered threshold. So we would do what I call a slow stop and keep them from going closer to the trigger. So that's one thing I did was watch all those videos. I also did a lot of reading, just as I did with the 50 books before I got Spoon. So I read a whole lot of scientific research, looked at the literature, and tried to figure out other ways, look at the underlying mechanism for why BAT might be working, and realized that it wasn't so much of the negative reinforcement aspect of moving away so much as the opportunity to just have control of the situation. And so I amped that up in the new version of BAT and made it so, and it was the control, but also just the experience, just the ability to see the stimulus and have expectancy violation where they expect that there might be something dangerous and then it turns out it isn't. And to really get that experience versus having it be really brief. And so I realized back to the threshold part that it was very reinforcing for people to put their dog over threshold. So what was happening is they would go in the old version of that, they would walk the dog toward the trigger, wait for the dog to disengage, mark with yes, and then move away. So that yes or the click or whatever, that moment was very reinforcing for the human. And so the human would seek that out over and over and over again. And so that would, that ended up making it so we were pushing the dogs to be over the threshold. And so now what we do is the dog, we just follow the dog, essentially. It's a very simple version of the technique. So I simplified the instructions as well, which I think make them more effective as well as also just easier to understand.
All right. So to recap,
okay,
you found out about CAT and you took,
constructional aggression treatment.
Constructional aggression treatment. And then you implied it and found some kind of modifications that you thought were beneficial. And so you took it to the CAT team. And they were like, not really our thing. And so you jokingly turned it into BAT. Mm-hmm. And here we are. And so you started implementing workshops and found that the dogs were continuously being put over threshold.
Right. So, yeah, then that's jumping forward quite a ways, right? So I did more work with clients and, you know, ended up writing the book and then the workshops. But, yeah. But yes, now that takes us to the end of 1.0.
And so twice in your life now, you've realized the necessity to gain information. And one thing that comes, because I suck at reading books, Grisha, because I'm so air quotes, because I hate this word podcast audience, and we're going to delete it out of my vocabulary very soon. Busy.
Yes. Maybe you need audiobooks then.
I do. It's, the challenge is the books. Some of the books you really want, they're not on audiobook, right? So
yeah, but I would call that cognitive dissonance, right there. because there are a lot of really good books on audio.
For sure. I have a tendency to want to read the books written by people like yourself that are is bet on people like yourself being podcast guests and people that I've gotten into contact with. All right, well, just put a request out there to
I have been thinking about it though.
Audify.
Yes, is it a word? Audify.
And so you did a lot of stuff with clients, and that brought us up to the end of 1.0, when you realized that, is it then that you realized that either something was wrong with the teaching or something was wrong with the people?
Exactly. I took a month off of everything. So I like doing a yearly sabbatical where I'm not doing any training or working with clients, anything, and I'm just learning something new. And so that was my focus for that year.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm learning so much just about life. about yearly sabbatical note, Ryan.
Right, because we work in the business so much that it's really nice to take a break to work on the business sometimes. And so some of those sabbaticals, I'm looking at my business structure. Some of those sabbaticals, I'm looking at when I'm teaching. So, yeah, very useful.
I love it, and I kind of want to just talk about sabbaticals now, but we won't. I'm going to stay on.
We can talk about whatever you want to talk about.
we're going to stay on spats. And then so you realize that a potential kind of generic way of looking at a dog about to go over threshold was you align the spine, or they align the spine, not you.
Right, don't do it.
towards the trigger. And then so you've made modifications since then to kind of – Am I heading down the right track here? Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, I wasn't the very first person to notice that spine alignment thing, but really, I maybe put a bigger emphasis on it than other people do now, because I think it's really the main one.
And then unpack this term a little bit more for me. You then talked about is it expectation violation?
Mm-hmm.
So unpack that a little bit more.
Yeah. So expectancy violation is basically. It comes from human psychology as well. So let's say you have a phobia of spiders. And so if you see a spider, your brain is catastrophizing. So it's thinking the spider is going to jump at me, or like all the expectation that it's going to go terribly. And then you look at it and you realize, actually, okay, that's a cartoon spider, so we're going to be cool here. And so your heart rate has a chance to lower down to the normal rate. And so it's actually built on the idea of cognitive dissonance. So there are two thoughts that are dissonant. There are two ideas, which is spiders are safe and they're not safe, right? So they're very different. And so, or that I'm safe or I'm not safe, right? For example. And so you have the dissonance of, now I thought I was going to be not safe, but I am safe. And so then your brain looks for a reason. Why am I safe in this situation? And so at first it's going to be like, okay, because it's a cartoon. But as you do more conditioning, so you would do like, you know, a real spider that's dead or whatever, and like build your way up to it, then it generalizes more and more and more. And so it creates this new paradigm. So yeah. So it's basically how we learn. And when therapy works, it's really, that's one of the main ways that it does work. So if you look at coherence therapy, it's a type of psychology for people. And that's really about kind of pulling out the baseline, the baseline statement that we have that we can then have in contrast with our reality. So I know we're going down a whole rabbit hole, but I really love this stuff. So I'll mention it quickly. So with coherence therapy, basically it's, let's say that you had some trauma as a child with men, right? So like maybe your father was angry. So you have this paradigm. If you take it down to like what the 2-year-old self would say is like, yelling men are dangerous, right? So some very simple statement like that. And you kind of figure out what's the one that resonates the most that kind of brings some emotion out in you. And then you really kind of allow yourself to sit with that and feel it and don't push it away and don't say like, well, that's stupid. Even if like your brain is like, yeah, no, it's not. They're not actually dangerous. And so then you sit with that, but then you have the expectancy violation. You look through after that piece, you look through like memories of your life or a recent experience and say, well, did I ever see an angry man and I wasn't actually in danger, right? And so you can kind of get that, those two experiences simultaneously, and then it ends up rewriting the rule. So you get some memory reconsolidation from that.
And so this is kind of a way of looking at it, and therefore then we can take that information and kind of start to think about what might be going on for our dogs.
Exactly. So in terms of our dogs, so they're, I mean, they obviously don't have the thinking about the event in words, but they do have the expectation, right? So if they see another dog, they expect that they're in danger. They react as if they're expecting they're in danger, at least. I have no idea what they're technically expecting. But then if you can create a scenario in which they see that trigger and yet they're completely safe, and that's usually because they're much further away. We allow, you know, anyway, you create the scenario where they're safe, and then their arousal can go back down to the point of, you know, just exploring the area. Then we do have some of that expectancy violation as well, and so I think that's part of what's happening with Bat.
And so you am I correct here? Tell me wrong, because I told you before the show, I've known a Bat for so long, and I've ordered my Bat 2.0 and Post lied to me, people. They lied to me. It's not here.
They didn't teleport it to you. Darn.
No. But I've done my research, and so I understand that. And once again, maybe I understand wrong. But so tell me, there's kind of three areas you focus on: their leash skills, setup, and survival. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through those?
Sure. And actually, before we do that, I just want to make sure to clarify something I just said in case it's unclear for people. So with Bat, we're not creating scenarios where the dog is like, oh my God, it's a dog, and then freaking out and then calming down. What we're doing is creating scenarios where it's like, I see trees, I smell bushes. Oh, hey, there's a dog. And yeah, I smell trees, I see bushes. So it's just like a non-event almost for them. So we don't want something that's hugely exciting for them. Now with humans, when they do a lot of this work with expectancy violation, they actually do cause more of an arousal spike. But I think because the humans know what's happening, that works. But I don't know that it would necessarily work or be ethical to do with dogs. And so that's why we work lower arousal. So, but anyway, back to your question. So there's three main pillars of Bat, and one is the leash skills. So to be able to use a 15-foot or 5-meter leash in a way that allows the dog to feel as off leash or free as possible, and then also makes it so that everybody's safe. So people aren't tripping over the leash, the dog's not stepping over it, people aren't getting rope burns, that kind of thing. So I've broken it down using tag teach as how to teach each individual skill. And that's been really useful. And then the other piece is survival skills. So things that you can just do on your regular walks that are not quite teaching for Bat, but it's allowing the dog to stay more below threshold during those walks. So they're not getting into trouble. And it's kind of like triage. So immediately the people have some skills that they can use so that their dog is not embarrassing them or freaking out on the walks. And then the real change then happens from the setups, which are facilitated by those leash skills. So effectively, basically, we have the dog on a 5-meter, 15-foot leash on a harness, and we're just wandering around an area that happens to also have a dog or whatever trigger in it. And it looks like the dog is basically just looking for a place to pee. It's super boring. I have a trainer who calls it boring aggression treatment. And so you just wander around, and our job is to be a parachute. So to use those leash skills from time to time to say, all right, looks like you're kind of approaching in a straight line toward the trigger. So we do a slow stop and wait for the dog to disengage, and then we go back to following. So that's the main human role. And so for people who are used to doing dog training that are really into control, it can be hard to like take a step back and say, I'm going to control the picture for the dog, but then let the dog have complete choice within that picture. It's very empowering for the dog, but can be kind of at first a little bit feel like you're not doing anything for the trainer. So,
yeah, I can imagine. And one of the things you mentioned there when you're talking about setup, I think it was when we're in the setup phase. You mentioned that it's not embarrassing for the owner. So you're trying to set them up to not be embarrassed. Is that, now I'm curious about this because, you know, just from like a marketing perspective. So when we're trying to sell this to people, and with any marketing, as I've been learning about business, social status is an important touch point when you're trying to communicate value to someone. So is that kind of something that you use to kind of sell this to people? Is that what the clients are looking for over like making their dogs feel better? They're kind of looking for making themselves prepare. Raising their social status, is that a way of putting it? I don't know.
I don't use it enough for the marketing, but probably could. But yeah, marketing is really all about like what's in it for me, right? And so there are different segments of the population. So we're in, more in the segment where it's like, I am the caregiver of this animal and his well-being is why I'm here, right? I want him to not feel stressed. I want him to feel comfortable. So that segment of the population I speak really easily with because those are my people. And then there's the like, I don't want to be embarrassed by my dog, which I have to some extent as well, right? I even mentioned that with Peanut. And so I think that justifies a lot of punishment that people do for dogs is that they're sort of like, people look at them like, well, why aren't you doing something? And so people, you know, grab their dogs or throw them to the ground or lift on their leashes or whatever as a show that yes, they're doing something. So there's that. And then there's also fear, right? So people are legitimately afraid either for their dog or afraid that their dog is going to hurt somebody else. And so those are all those components in terms of safety, in terms of having more fun with their dogs. And I think fun is sort of, sometimes I promote that as sort of being the opposite of the embarrassment piece. So, but you could also say a dog you can be proud of, right? Would be calling upon that piece as well. And I also think that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
I also think that a lot of clients come to us as their dogs are like their first kids, right? So they're learning how to parent through dog training. And I think that we should be very mindful that the tools that we give people are then creating the kind of children and adults that we want in society because they're going to be using these tools on their kids too. So
that's cool.
Yeah. And I think we need to be really careful about creating addictions personally.
We talk about that with animals in zoos about showcasing what we're doing so that our zoo visitors go home and share it with their dogs so that they then treat their kids better.
Exactly. Oh yep.
So just looking at time, God, Ryan. Well done, Ryan. I'm trying to reinforce myself, not punish myself.
There you go. Good job noticing the time. There you go.
On live on the podcast. Before we move on, just maybe for people that are dealing with reactive, aggressive, fearful dogs and they haven't heard of BAT or they haven't thought about trying BAT before, obviously going out and looking at your website and either purchasing a book or looking at the DVD options, what are some other simple tips that just one or two simple tips you can give the listeners of the show that might want to start to think about this new way of dealing with some challenges they're having?
Let's see, a couple of quick tips. One would be to film everything. So film all of your sessions so that you can go back and figure out what you would change, how you would improve that. So definitely filming. And also a lot of people have formed BAT Facebook groups for their communities. So either create one or find one. I have a directory of those on my website under chat groups because that's a really good way to find other dogs to practice with. I know it can be challenging to find decoys, either humans or dogs. And so BAT is a technique where you can have both dogs have reactivity and be working with each other doing that. So, and actually, can I jump in for one other thing? Mm-hmm. That's just correcting you slightly because I think yes. Susan Friedman would want me to. I don't use the term reactive dogs or aggressive dogs.
Yeah.
So I always try to put it on to the behavior. So it's a dog with behavior or with reactive behavior, for example, rather than a reactive dog because they're not reactive 100% of the time, but they do have a set of their behaviors that's overreactive.
Okay, so if you have a dog that you're hypothesizing is exhibiting behaviors we might label as reactive.
There's got to be a faster way, but yeah, dogs with aggressive behavior. Yes, I know it's so much faster just to say aggressive dogs, but it's a good habit to get into with our dogs and our because we also use it with people too, and then labeling them as something, the label sticks. And so, yeah, we tend to do more corrections when it's like the dog is an aggressive dog versus a dog that has an aggression problem.
That has this behavior under this antecedent condition.
Exactly.
With this reinforcement history.
I hear Susan talking through you right now.
No, it's a great catch, and I'm really grateful that you remind me of that. And we're safe, I think, with the audience of this podcast being behavior nerds. Maybe wrong. I don't have accurate data to 100% back that up. But it's important for us to consistently remind ourselves that, yeah, the word reactive is not describing behavior. I think.
Describing the animal. Yeah. So that we're labeled the behavior, not the animal, basically. Mm. At least as far as I'm concerned. Maybe Susan would phrase it differently, but.
No, I love it. And thank you for adding that little input there. I'm always up to throw some ABA on what we're talking about.
You should see me with Susan. It's like, I feel like I'm completely being taught. By the end, I'm just like, okay, I shall behave.
Hey, thank you so much for sharing that. So everyone can find out where to get more content on this via grissastewart.com. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, perfect. So once again, we'll link to all of that in the show notes. And you have a little video that I think it's on the homepage of your website, is it? That, or maybe it's in the bat section about what bat is. It's like 10 minutes long. I watched it this morning.
Yeah, I think. And it's also on my YouTube, on my Facebook. I have an Instagram, but it's not on there. But yeah, so what is bat is definitely in the Facebook page.
So we'll share that video on the podcast write-up as well, and maybe the bat song, which I'm excited to watch now. Hey, thanks so much for sharing. That was a ton of fun. For our next question, though, I wanted to talk about consent. Can you define this for us, please, Grisha? And why you told me it's something you really wanted to talk about today.
Right. So I don't know if you've noticed, but the world has gotten a little bit crazy, especially on the side of the pond. And I think consent is especially important these days as we realize, like in terms of human beings, but also in terms of our animals, right? So I have a workshop or a webinar on my site called Don't Grab the Pussycat. And it's about ways that we can ask for and receive consent from our animals. And so I'm sure in some of your other podcasts, you've talked about that cooperative care, but I think it's, in general, also just a really good way to think about teaching children about consent. I think that we do things to, you know, dogs and kids that we wouldn't do to adults. Like we make them finish their food, for example. Like we ask kids to like eat all their food, even past the point of the point where their own body has said, I'm full, right? And I think that's a violation of that boundary. So having respectful boundaries that our dogs can set and people can set, I think is important. And so with dogs, for example, we use the more please signal. So a more please signal is something like chin targeting, right? So the dog can target his chin onto your hand. And then as long as he's holding the chin target, that means that the counter conditioning that you're doing is something that he's comfortable with. So Bean, for example, will hold his chin on my hand and then I'll look into his ears, give him a treat, look into his ears, give him a treat. And if at any point he pulls away, then I just pull my hand and pull the, you know, the inspecting hand back, wait for him to retarget, and then we go back to the activity. So it's a way for him to give consent and also to say, hey, I'm ready for this procedure as well, instead of me just like grabbing his ears.
And so is this built into stuff you do in bat? Where is like, what kind of touch points do we have with regards to something like you just described with the chin target?
Mm-hmm. So with bat, a lot of the dogs also have issues with being handled. And so it would definitely be that chin targeting specifically would be part of that. And then I also think just instigation. So where the dog is doing most of the approach toward people, rather than beginning as we often do with counter conditioning, where it's like the people approach, here's a treat, people approach, here's a treat. And the dog really doesn't have control over that process. And so I think no matter what the tool is, people can benefit from learning about bat and then applying that philosophy to other techniques.
Love it. And I know there's a ton of people who are listening to the show who are going to resonate with this and for whom everything so far is going to be highly beneficial. So once again, thank you so much for sharing. Next, I was hoping to talk about another species, that species being us. And appreciating, of course, that all animals are individuals, we're going to talk about the individual now and how we can apply what we know about training and behavior, as we started to dive into a little bit earlier, to ourselves and our own learning journeys. Grisha, can you talk to this for us?
Sure. So So anytime we learn something, right, I tend to apply this to every area of my own life, and I'm sure other people do as well to some extent. And there is a really good book called The Power of Habits that is it's one of those that I think that it would resonate with just regular people. But if you're a dog trainer, it's like, you know, like my head just kind of exploded in terms of how useful that would be to change my own behavior. So I had several habits that I didn't want and several habits that I did want to try to have. And I know enough about, you know, behavior analysis to really have done this before, but it kind of wasn't until I read that book that I really got the idea of like setting myself up for success. So after I read that book, I ended up losing 25 pounds in about a month and a half. I started walking my dogs more. I started training them more. I started meditating, and all really because I changed the antecedents. So because, you know, we think of our own habits as really being about self-control, and they aren't. Like our dogs, it's not about self-control so much as the antecedents and what that leads them to do, right? And so, yes, there's a certain amount of self-control involved, but we don't have to be like throw ourselves into the deep end of the pool where we immediately are like, oh, there's ice cream in the freezer, you know, don't eat it. So doing things like, obviously, you know, removing of the various things you don't want to eat. But then I also put a note on the refrigerator that said, what substitute behavior do I want? Right. So we always look for a replacement behavior that can be reinforced. And so I put as a substitute, two substitute behaviors. One is go drink some water, because that's usually what we do if we're hungry, or like that we're actually thirsty, but we think we're hungry. And then I also put look for signs of life as a note on my fridge. And what that means is to go to my window and look outside, because I'm probably bored and that's why I'm at the fridge. And so at my window, I have another sign, a little note for myself that has about 25 activities that I could do to entertain myself at that given moment. So I can exercise, I can play with the dogs, I can play music, I can drink tea, like all kinds of things that don't involve eating. And so I was able to then meet the need, right? Because it's really about what's the craving, right? So that book talks about craving, but it's really like, what's the functional reinforcer? Like what's the maintaining consequence that's keeping that behavior going? And so whether it's, you know, smoking for some people or whatever else, like figuring out why do we actually do it, right? So smoking, a lot of times it's a way to, you know, take a break or socialize, or like there's other reasons why people might be doing that. And to be able to get that need met in a way that's more healthy for you is great. And of course, creating a competing habit is the best way to change behavior.
Okay, cool. So,
or one of the best ways anyway.
Well, say that last bit again.
I said one of the best ways anyway, because with that, we're not necessarily creating a competing habit so much as reducing arousal. So it's like that's a piece of it as well, as putting ourselves in the situation where we can be successful. So meditation, for example, was probably part of why a lot of those other things were working, because I was also in a generally calmer state. And so I wasn't eating out of stress either, for example.
So as immediate antecedents and consequences, because the consequence of you going to the fridge.
Mm-hmm. Well, the consequence was the same in terms of a functional category, right? So I wasn't getting the food, but I was getting the entertainment, which is really, I was looking for a distraction. Uh-huh. So it didn't necessarily matter that it was food, but that I was getting something.
It was kind of like the pre-set up addition of information when you got to the fridge.
Say that one more time.
It was kind of like the pre-set up of additional information. Mm-hmm. So it was like the adding of go to the window.
Exactly. And I had another antecedent arrangement, which was that I took the rug out from under, like there was a rug in front of the fridge. And so mm-hmm. I could like stand there longer, right, if there was a rug, because it was warm. So once that carpet was removed, then it also became a little bit of a different stimulus, right? So I wasn't going to my target mat and standing. I would say mat was removed. So, yep.
It's funny to laugh at it, but then at the same time, like, yeah, right?
Right? It's exactly. We're just less furry animals. Yeah.
Depends on who we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so when we were talking earlier, and when I say earlier, I mean two things, actually. And let's start with this one because I've started with it. When we were talking earlier, like a month ago, we talked about sometimes, you know, using these tools like positive reinforcement, applying them to ourselves, but not just, and maybe your answer has already answered this, changing the external environment to change your internal environment. And we're talking about, like self-talk and just negative self-talk. We talked about imposter syndrome already in this podcast. How can we use what we know from positive reinforcement and ABA to influence that internal side of the environment? Is it by trying to intentionally change thought patterns, or is it by changing our external antecedents?
Mm-hmm. So our thought patterns are just behavior as well. So we're simultaneously the observer of that behavior and the person doing that behavior. So we try to use it as a consequence, right? But if we can pull back and observe more, right? So our sort of true trainer is the awareness level, where we see, oh, look, I'm doing that negative self-talk again. And so when we catch that, right, then at that level, we can say, like, good job, I just totally caught myself, right? Instead of saying like, oh no, I did it again, right? And then you just end up in the spiral of the negative self-talk. So actually consider it to be like a clickable moment when you notice that kind of self-talk, because it means you can catch yourself sooner and sooner in the process, because it's like a behavior chain, right? And so that's one piece. The other piece is to specifically then, you know, replace that with, you know, positive self-talk, right? If you're trying to actually change a behavior, do it in a way like I described before, where you can reinforce alternate behavior. And you don't necessarily need to do it with, like, even with positive self-talk, but just like getting your needs met. So it's the idea that you can change your behavior through shame that needs to just go away. It's just not useful. So there's a researcher, Brené Brown. Sorry, I'll just keep throwing resources at you, but Brené Brown talks about shame. It's one of her major subjects. And she describes how shame does not change behavior. Like, it's not a motivator of behavior change. It is, it changes behavior in terms of like downward spiral, but like not fixing the behavior you were trying to shame. Guilt can change behavior. So guilt is very behavior focused. Like actually something really terrible happened this week and I messed up, and my nephew ended up, one of his guinea pigs died because of miscommunication and heat and some things. And so I could have jumped to shame that, like, I'm a terrible aunt or I'm a terrible animal person or whatever else. But I didn't. But what I did jump to is guilt. So guilt is, oh my God, I totally messed up. This needs to not ever happen again. Here are some things I can change so that behavior doesn't happen, but not really going along that level of I'm a bad person. And so if you have self-talk in terms of like, oh, well, let's not do that again. Like, that can be very useful, that rumination up to a point, right? And so it's like finding an actual solution and doing that instead is great. But when it becomes critical of something that you're like, that you wouldn't normally say to any other person besides for yourself, then that's the kind of thing that's not useful. Right. Yeah, well, kind of like do your shame talk out loud, it'd be like, you idiot. Like, you wouldn't say that to your child or your friend. Right. Maybe some people do say it to their child, but like self-aware people don't. So I don't know. Am I making sense?
Yes.
Somewhat. Okay.
and one other thing, we're talking about labels a little bit earlier in this podcast. When how people define it and how me define as well. It's one thing I've been thinking about recently. And I guess it's different for each situation and each people. But when you're talking about the word habit, like, what kind of, like, what does that mean for you? Can you define that for us? please.
Yes. So a habit is a behavior that has been reinforced to the point that the process where you decide whether you're doing it or not has effectively been bypassed. So there's research that says that like there's brain activity if you don't have a habit, there's brain activity of choice of like, what am I going to do here? And that brain activity just isn't there when it's a habit. So it's like your brain is just like, oh, we know what to do. And you just go right to that. So that's, for me, that's a habit, is something that you do without really needing to think about it.
So is it kind of like an antecedent there, and there isn't much cognitive processing?
Exactly.
To the behavior. How do we apply this? Because I hear people talking about it with their animals. How do we take that to our animals? Is there danger in saying the animal has a habit? Does it disempower us somewhat?
I don't know. I actually almost see it as an empowering thing, right? So it's because we think of habit as an addiction, and we know that addictions can usually be canceled out of people rather than it being like he is an alcoholic. I don't know. I guess people still say that, but like it's something that's maintained by consequences. It's not something that is inherent in the being, right? It's not an aggressive dog. It's a dog that has a habit of responding aggressively in this scenario. Right. And so we can create a different habit.
Right. So we're saying that in this antecedent, this dog does these set behaviors that we're describing as aggressive. And there's very small choice in that gap between the antecedent and behavior. It's kind of just like.
Exactly. And so what that does is it allows us to sort of realize that the dog isn't like deliberately doing this. Right. It's just something that's somewhat out of his control at this point. And so we need to create scenarios that are in the dog's control that look different enough that they're able to be successful. And so, because if we call it a habit, I think people are also used to their own habits and how hard it is to break them. And so, or to change them or replace them. And so I think it gives some compassion and empathy for the dogs. And anytime we have that, we have a more effective treatment that we can come up with usually. And it back, you know, in terms of change of human beings, which is to me one of the main things we can do as trainers, right, is that now that they have seen their dog change a habit, that empowers them to be able to change some of their own habits. And of course, that's how we change the dogs, right, is by changing the habits of the people.
I love it.
Which I think trainers need to think about when we think about why is my client not compliant. It's because they have habits that they need to change as well.
And so this book, The Power of Habits, is written by?
Robert Duhigg, D-U-H-I-G-G.
Okay. And look into that audiobook for a future.
Yes, it is an audiobook.
Woohoo! So, yes. I can actually get through that one.
And to be fair, so, you know, all of the changes that I mentioned, I read the first two-thirds of that book and it was like, okay, got it, and ran. So, you don't have to read even the whole book to get all. I'm sure there's more benefit in the second part, but I haven't gotten to that yet. Because I started talking about institutions, and I don't really run an institution. So, but like within businesses and that kind of thing. So.
So what are some other, was that the main takeaway? And was there other significant information that you took from that book that you also applied to your situations? You mentioned taking your dog for a walk more often.
So I'm trying to think. So, I'm going to give a piece of advice that wasn't in that book because it just occurred to me. So, I printed out a calendar, just like a blank calendar using my iCal or whatever. So, and then on each day that I did the thing that I was trying to do, I like colored it in, or I, wrote on it. But the more obvious it is, like if you color in the whole square, it's much more effective than if you just put a check in the square. Because then like across the room, I can look and see, like, that's my reinforcer for continuing with the new behavior, is to see all of those checks or all those shaded in areas. So that's one thing that I would recommend, as well as like a chart that keeps track of it. And I'm terrible with data collection. Like, I'm a scientist, but I suck at data collection. And so that's one thing that I found really useful, is that very simple way to do that. But then back to that book, one of the things that was was really interesting was a story about there's a cleaning spray. Actually, I can't even remember the name of it right now. Febreze. So do you have that over there?
We do. Yeah.
So it's a dog. Anyway, so Febreze has deadens odor, but it also has its own good smell. And so when they first came out with it, it bombed entirely until they really looked at the human behavior and said, how can we create a craving for this? And so the way they created a craving was to create a ritual or a habit that basically people sprayed this at the end of their cleaning. So that smell became a negative reinforcer to them that their cleaning process was over. And so they ended up being addicted to it. And so then eventually they said, oh, and by the way, it also eliminates odor. But by then they had created enough of a craving in people for the smell of it in the first place that that's why they were buying it.
I like it. And the other person you mentioned there with the shaming research.
Mm-hmm. So Brené Brown, B-R-E-N-E, and then Brown, like the color.
Okay.
Oh, and back to the habits book. Another piece is that it turns out that toothpaste, it doesn't have to foam. And it doesn't have to have mint in it. Those are both reinforcers. They're meant to actually create an immediate reinforcer for the process of brushing your teeth.
I love mint, by the way. Anyway.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Distracted.
Mint or cinnamon or something that like burns the mouth is actually, that's why they're in there as a reinforcer for brushing your teeth.
Awesome. Hey, looking at the time, we're going to move on to...
Well, we can't talk about brushing teeth. No. Anyway.
I would actually love to do a whole episode on brushing teeth. Have you seen some of the videos on YouTube about how you teach kids to brush teeth?
I saw, and Susan one time had that in her talks, and comparing like how easy it is to brush dog's teeth with training. So it's funny.
Yeah, we had one shared at a workshop recently in Wellington, and it was, I think I've seen one in Susan's online course years ago, so I don't know if she's still using the same one, but this one was even more horrific, and as a doctor as well, it was like a human doctor.
Oh, no!
And I was like, pin this kid down. Oh, okay. So let's shelf that for another podcast episode.
Anyway, yeah, go ahead.
We are nearly at the end, but that's okay because we are heading into one of my favorite parts of the podcast show, and this is called Story Time. Grisha, can you share either, just looking at time, either one story or two quick stories maybe, from your experience training animals so far and some of the important lessons you've learned along the way?
Well, so I guess I'll tell the story about Peanut because I know the most about him. He was my dog. And a couple of pieces. So one is when I was a new trainer, I was very, very addicted to the idea of, I guess addicted isn't the right word, but I really was highly reinforced by control, like by getting behavior out of him. So, reinforcing him for going over the jumps or agility things or jumping my arms. He could walk backwards about 100 feet. And so all of these tricks were very reinforcing to me, and it seemed like relationship, and it is relationship. But that was, as he got older and as I got older, and thinking about control and getting more control in my own life and inner control, that became less important to me than empowering him as his own being and being able to understand and have him communicate back to me through his behavior what he's interested in. And so I realized I had created this very strong imbalance toward external reinforcers in terms of treats and toys, and less so about interaction with his own species and with people. And I think that good caregiving really is about maintaining a healthy balance for dogs and not sort of creating this addiction, because it really is addiction in terms of toys. For example, he was like Gollum in the Ring of Power, like my precious, you know, like when the toys would come out. And it was, it was later in his life than I started teaching him how to be a dog again. And in terms of just exploring the area and saying hello to other dogs and people and that kind of thing. And so that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is, you know, he passed away at 13 and a half, and training is not really the important piece. Like the important piece is the relationship, and these animals are with us for a short period of time. They are visitors from, you know, their culture into ours. And when we think about what we're training, you know, whether it's positive reinforcement or punishment or whatever else, I think the more we think about them as their own beings, the more effectively we can, like, just a better life we can have for ourselves and for them. And certainly it makes it so that punishment is, especially forceful punishment, is off the table completely, right? They're guests in our home, and why would we punish them for not understanding our culture? So I'm going to leave it at that.
I'm going to say, obviously, sorry about the loss of your friend, Peanut. At the same time, thank you, Peanut, for teaching Grisha and for, you know, still living on today here in this podcast recording and reaching many ears and teaching us lessons. Mm-hmm. So a bit of sadness there, and also some appreciation.
And the other thing I guess I should add is also that he died about 2 years ago, and I had what's called anticipatory grief, like pre-grief for him, that for a couple of years before he died, I was always like, not always, but I would often like tear up thinking about, him passing away. And that it turned out that once he actually did pass away, that there was the pre-grief that was really the harder struggle. But that after he had passed away, it was a very interesting time of transformation and reflection for me, that I could just purely feel sad and allow that grief to be there and sit with it and pass through me. But it didn't have the complication that happens from that anxiety, the anticipation of their death. And so I guess for all of you out there that have senior dogs, that, enjoy this time as much as you can, and, don't live in that future. Live, with the time that you have now, and that it's not necessarily going to be as bad as you think. So, and yes, it will be sad. Like, I threw up. I was so sad. So it's, or almost did. It's, it was terrible, but sadness is not terrible. It's just part of life. It's just an experience, and we don't have to be upset about additionally that we're sad. We can just be sad.
And I'm not certain that's going to be applicable to so many listeners of the show. Whether you have dogs or horses or zoo animals or whatever species you're working with. So thank you for that, sharing that last little bit there. Before we do officially wrap up, Grisha, one more thing. Can you just take us all, we started with young 12, 13-year-old babysitter Grisha. Take us into the future now. Where would you like to see everything we're doing go over the next 5 to 10 years?
I would like to go more in the direction of consent, but I would also like, just as an industry, I'd like us to be regulated more. I would like it to be, I'd like education to be a bigger piece in all the various countries. I would like some of the tools that are out there to no longer be in use. I really like how some countries have actually banned the use of prong collars and e-collars and that kind of thing. And I think that any activism we could do in the behalf of the animals, I think, is really useful. And then, like I said, I think in terms of my own training, and hopefully I see a lot of people going in that direction as well, is in that direction of consent and two-way communication, and building up the idea that training can be used for not just us showing that we have control over the dog, but actually allowing us to have good bedside manner at the veterinarians, right, where we can communicate to the dog that something's about to happen, they know what to expect, they feel more comfortable. So using training for the welfare of the dog and not just for making it easier for ourselves. So I think that's where we're headed. And I'm going to circle back one piece. On my website, I do have an article about, or two articles about grief. So for anyone who found that part resonated with them, that there's a couple of articles there that might be useful.
All right. When our listeners is back, I'll jot down all of these and make sure we get all of these links for you beautiful people out there, so you can come and check these out when and if you want to. We will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes, as just mentioned. But can you just remind everyone listening, Grisha, where they can go once again?
Sure. Simply, so my website is grishastewart.com. And that's also my Instagram and my Facebook.
So is that the best way to get in touch with you, is to send you a message from the contact form on that page?
The best way to get in contact if you have a specific question about any of the courses I do or that kind of thing would be through the contact on my website. If you're looking for how to do BAT specifically, or if you're doing it, you need like practical advice on your video or that kind of thing, probably the official Facebook group would be the best way, because then you get trainers worldwide that can help answer that. I tend not to always be online, which is part of my own self-care.
Mm-hmm. And is it a free Facebook group, or is it part of your?
Yeah, perfect. I have two groups. I have a BAT Facebook group, and then I have one that's for the online school, so the Animal Building Blocks Academy. And so both of those are linked from my website, but I'll give you those links too.
Awesome. Wonderful. And order her book, and hopefully it gets to you in a timely manner.
There's ebooks right through my website that could have gotten there like instantly.
I used to buy ebooks, and then now I have this like habit.
I have shelves and shelves of books. In addition to my ebooks, so yeah,
it's reinforcing for me to see like all the actual physical books.
Yeah, sometimes it's nice to grab it off a shelf and be like, "This part," or you can highlight it. Yeah, not the same in an ebook.
Hey, Grisha, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, we really appreciate you taking the time to catch up with me a month ago, send messages back and forth, get your bio ready, send me all the links, everything, and jumping on the call with me today. So thank you very much. Thank you fairly much. I don't even know what that word is. I just made up a word, everyone. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan. It's been my pleasure.
It's super appreciated. And we, of course, really appreciate all of you out there tuning in today as well. If you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich, consent-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the ATA Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening, everyone, and you will hear from us again soon.